First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Children under 12 still can't get the vaccine. Florida parents getting them ready for a new school year say they're worried. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead on this rainy Monday, we'll tell you why some parents want Duval County Public Schools to bring back a mask mandate when classes start up again in a few weeks. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, a COVID nurse speaks out about the critical situation at local hospitals caring for unvaccinated patients who are crowding ICUs and getting desperately sick. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic in its weekly report Friday. The State Department of Health reported Florida has added 73,199 new COVID infections. That includes 6,430 new cases in Duval County in the past week. The positivity rate in Duval rose to 25.7%. Baker, Clay, Nassau, Putnam, and St. John's counties all saw their numbers rise sharply as well. We are a hot spot, folks, for this virus right now because of the Delta variant mainly. Now, CDC data shows that the admission of patients here in Florida with COVID-19 surged 54% compared to last week, including over 1,000 new statewide admissions on Wednesday. And in almost all of our local hospitals, the number of patients afflicted with the virus is approaching the highest level since the big peak we had in early February or in late January. The Florida Department of Health also reports an increase of 282 deaths from last week's report. And Jacksonville took another terrible blow over the weekend when the CEO of U of Health Jacksonville, Dr. Leon Haley, died in a boating accident. Haley was the first person in town to receive the COVID vaccine. He did it publicly on camera to bolster confidence in getting the shot. And he had been a vital leader in the healthcare space in fighting this pandemic. Our condolences to his family, friends, and colleagues, and may his memory be a blessing. Now, at the same time, statistics show that only 50% of Duval County residents age 12 or older are vaccinated against COVID-19. That is compared to 60% for Florida as a whole. We can't stress this enough, everyone. Please, let's get those numbers up and get vaccinated. Keep in mind, kids under 12 can't get the vaccine, and students in our area are preparing to return to school in a few weeks. In Duval County, masks for the unvaccinated are strongly recommended, but they are not mandatory. So, dozens of concerned parents, teachers, medical professionals, faith leaders all got together Sunday to rally, and they called on Superintendent Dr. Diana Green and the Duval County School Board to require face masks for students when classes resume next month. Wearing masks and distancing or participating from their cars, they were all together outside school district headquarters Sunday night holding up signs saying things like masks save lives. Now, Matt Hartley is the father of two students in the Duval schools. One of them is too young to be vaccinated. He helped organize Sunday's rally, and he's on the line. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Melissa.
It's good to have you. Thanks for holding on there while I set this up, because we had a lot of information to go through. And as we talk about the return of school, let us know your thoughts, folks. Do you think schools should require masks once again? 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax or weigh in on our Facebook page. So, Matt, kids go back on August 10th. The policy in Duval is strongly recommended for unvaccinated kids. They upgraded that from optional. Duval County Schools still has an optional mask policy. Tell us more about the concerns of parents that took part in this rally and what you're asking the school board to do.
Well, you've outlined so well in your intro just what a critical situation we're in with COVID and the Delta variant locally. we can all see, we've heard through friends who work in the medical system, we've heard in the news from our hospitals that many people are coming in, and some of them are kids too. And even though we know that many of our kids do okay with a COVID infection, some do not. And I don't want my kid or any other person's kid to be the one who ends up hospitalized or with long COVID symptoms. And as a former teacher as well, you know, I care about every single student in the classroom. And so what masking does, it's a real easy thing we can all do to slow the spread of COVID.
You've got a rising seventh grader who is old enough to be vaccinated, but your son will be a rising fifth grader and too young to be vaccinated. Is that right?
That's correct.
So you're worried about your youngest?
I'm worried about him most of all. You know, last year, Duval Schools really worked hard from, you know, the policy was required masks, and our teachers, our staff, worked so hard to make it a safe environment for our students. And there were just isolated cases. I just got calls occasionally from both of my kids' schools, and this was before either of them could be vaccinated, about cases of COVID. So we know that the policy worked last year, and we really applaud the superintendent, the school board, for having that required mask policy. And that's why we want to see it continue as this really dangerous spike is happening.
We'll go to your calls in a moment, 549-2937. The school district did put out a statement about this, and I want to get your reaction to it. They noted that they're following a recommendation from the Florida Department of Education that face masks for students be voluntary for the upcoming school year. That numbers show the risk of infection in children is considerably less than in adults. Superintendent Dr. Diana Green says the school district will continue to advocate for COVID vaccines for school-based personnel and students. She says the good news is that many kids are wearing masks when they take part in summer school and enrichment activities. What's your reaction?
Well, I'm grateful that the recommendation was increased to strongly recommended. But, you know, again, as a former teacher, but also a person in Jacksonville, we know that we can see that where masks are not required, where they're only recommended, they are worn sporadically. And the more they're worn sporadically, the more likely that virus, especially this more contagious Delta variant, will be out in the air in our schools, putting all of our kids and all of our adults at risk too. I mean, we're seeing breakthrough cases too. So occasionally people who've been vaccinated are getting sick and can spread COVID, or even occasionally we hear of people who have breakthrough cases who are hospitalized too.
You know, it's my understanding that the school board doesn't want to defy the Department of Education in mandating masks, even though they technically have the authority to do so at the local level. The reality is that they're concerned about going against Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran and the Department of Ed, who have said that masks need to be voluntary. This flies in the face of recommendations from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the American Academy of Pediatrics. They both believe kids should stay masked are going into school in a few weeks, considering how high the case count is right now. So there are politics involved in this, Matt. And for parents and activists such as yourself, how do you plan to respond to that?
Well, I mean, Melissa, you're so right. And we've heard that from the governor, too. But the governor's made clear through saying that he'll go back to legislative session. In saying that, he makes clear that right now it is a local decision.
Right. Let me just explain. The governor says he will call a special legislative session if the federal government says that kids must be masked when they go back to school. The governor says he will fight that with a special legislative session here in Florida. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah. So, you know, the governor and the education commissioner are wrong about this, and our medical experts are right about this. When the AAP and the CDC tell us this is the right thing to do, it's the good science. That means it's also the moral thing to do to keep our kids safe. And we heard from a number of our speakers yesterday, like City Councilor Joyce Morgan, State Senator Audrey Gibson, and we were all there to support the school board in doing a hard thing. It is a hard thing to stand up to those leaders who are wrong, but we need to do it to keep all of our kids safe when they go back.
Let's go to some calls now as we speak with parent Matt Hartley. He partnered up with the grassroots group Duval Schools Pandemic Solutions Team to rally Sunday, asking school leadership in Duval to mandate masks when kids return in a few weeks. Let us know your thoughts. 549-2937. Jessica is in East Arlington. Hi, Jessica. Good morning.
Hi. Hi, good morning. So I'm calling because my son was at Camp Immokalee, which is breaking news because they had an outbreak. I'm emotional about it.
I'm so sorry.
Did not test positive.
Good.
We got very lucky. But at the 110 campers they sent home, 18 at least were positive, because last I saw on the news was 17, and I know at least one other camper has been positive since then. That's almost 20%. They reacted so much faster than Duval County can react. They didn't contact trace. They just sent us all home, and then they contact traced. I can't even imagine the outbreaks that we're going to have in schools. I work summer school. I work for DCPS, and we had no students in masks. Some of them got off the bus wearing masks and immediately took them off, and we could not tell them to put them back on. And we did have cases over the summer. And that's with much smaller classes. And, you know, at Immokalee, they reacted the next day. Mm-hmm. The camper tested positive Wednesday evening. And at Thursday morning at 8 a.m., I had a call to come pick up my son. Duval County takes 1 to 2 days to contact trace. And they don't send home everybody. They just send home people who were nearby that child. We are going to have outbreaks. We saw it happen with Fletcher. We saw it happen with VA, where students were getting together outside of school without masks.
So you believe you want the schools to do a mask mandate, Jessica?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Jessica. Lots of calls. Let me just get to a few, and they're coming from surrounding counties as well. Rainey in Nassau County. Hi, Rainey. Go ahead. Go ahead, Rainey.
Yeah. As you mentioned, I'm in Nassau County. We're in a very same situation. Numbers here are exploding. Our hospitals are full. And I just think it's unconscionable that we would send our children back into an environment where they could potentially be sick. I have two children in the Nassau County school system. One's a teenager who is vaccinated, and one's a seven-year-old. And my seven-year-old needs the additional services that are offered through the school. So we have really struggled on what to do in terms of sending him back. He needs to be in school. And I just think that we need to have full COVID protocol in place, including a mask mandate. It's unreasonable to ask our kids to go back in the situation with the Delta variant, 5 to 10 second exposure, and kids getting very, very ill. We do not yet even know what we're dealing with on a full scale. So why not take precautions for our most vulnerable kids in our society?
Rainey, thanks for the call. Leah in San Marco, what do you think, Leah?
Yes, hi, Melissa. Thank you for covering such an important topic.
Sure.
I have two children under age 12, and of course, they do not yet have access to the COVID vaccine. And until they do, which we're hoping will be this winter, we really feel masks should be mandatory to keep all children safe from this virus. And the other thing is that I think, you know, educators need to remember is by keeping kids healthy, we also keep them in the classroom, which is where we all want them to be. We don't want them to be virtual. We want them to be with their teachers and their friends in the classroom learning. And as you mentioned, the CDC and AAP both recommend requiring masks for students. And it just seems to make sense that our school board and our elected leaders should be listening to our medical experts on this. Why risk it? It's an easy way to prevent the spread of this deadly virus, and we should all be doing it.
Thank you, Leah. Pam in Jacksonville. Pam, what say you?
Hi. Yes. I say that the mask mandate is very important. I know my granddaughter wore masks in school all last year. She had no problem at all wearing them. She really liked them. And the vaccinated people and the unvaccinated people, I find that the unvaccinated people are in three groups. They're the political ones, which are a smaller group, I think, at this point. I think the other two groups are the ones who are afraid of a new vaccine, and they think that it's going to do something very strange to their body. And this is a very well-researched and thought-up vaccine. It's very safe, and everybody should want to get it to save their children, to save their elderly people, to save all the immunocompromised people that we have in our population. And the third group are the ones that think that their rights to freedom are being chipped away. And they're being no more chipped away than all the vaccines that we require for children just to go to school.
That's right, Pam.
And this one is absolutely important for that.
Thank you so much, Pam. And thank you for calling in as a healthcare professional and a nurse practitioner. Okay. So Matt Hartley, that gives you a very unscientific sample of public opinion, you know, and it's interesting to hear from parents out there. I have to personally disclose that we have one daughter who just graduated this spring from the Duval County Public Schools. We have, she's been vaccinated. She's 18. Our 15-year-old has also been vaccinated, and I am very grateful for that since she will be starting class in a Duval County public school in a few weeks. She plans to stay masked up, and so do her friends. I just needed to disclose that as we discuss this. What's your reaction to hearing these comments? And let me get your reaction from this comment on Facebook, too. Kate writes, the kids are used to the masks. If they can't be vaccinated, it's a no-brainer to have them mask up. What about that, you know, the kids really are used to this by now?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, Melissa, my son, I love him. He complains about everything that is uncomfortable to him, he doesn't want to do. And yet masks, he does not complain about at all because he knows it keeps him safe and it keeps his classmates safe. So I totally agree with that comment. And I think, you know, what we're hearing, this is what we knew when a bunch of us came together for this rally, was that there's a lot of parents out there, a lot of community members, even those who aren't parents, to know this is the right thing to do to keep our kids safe as we start back to school.
Here's a tweet from a teacher named Chris, who speaks out quite a bit on educational issues. He tweets the show, asking school leadership to stand up to the destructive policies of the state, not just with COVID, but with so many other issues, is like asking water not to be wet. We need a board and a superintendent to fight for our schools. But instead, we have one that asks how high when told to jump. Now, the school board and the superintendent would likely disagree with that. That said, the leaders of school districts around the state are in a tough spot right now because they are hearing from parents, Matt, like you, at the same time that they are likely concerned about retaliation from the state level if they defy these directives.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why we're speaking up, is to let them know that we are standing with them, we have their back, we support them in making this decision, because we know it's not easy.
And, but let's take that further. You say you support them, but let's just say, for the sake of argument, a school district defies the state on this, they get sued, or maybe they're threatened with some kind of loss of funding. There could be a range of consequences. That's not something that parent activists can necessarily do anything about in the short term. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we can try to game out the potential, you know, windfalls from all these decisions, but ultimately we know that we want our kids to be safe on August 10th, and they all need to be wearing masks. I mean, I think it's as simple as that for us.
We want to also make mention of the fact that in the interest of full disclosure, producer Heather Schatz here on this program, her son attends school in St. Johns County. He did contract COVID-19 and he was seriously ill for months. He has long COVID, you know, long-term effects of the illness. And I bring that up just to say that it is a real fear among parents. Your child can get very sick, although it's much less likely for children to get very sick than it is senior citizens and older adults who have comorbidities and things like that. So the risk of infection is lower in kids, but that's not to say it's non-existent. And we have seen firsthand evidence of that right here in our group at work. According to the Centers for Disease Control, every county in Florida is now listed as having high rates of COVID transmission. Let's go to Heddle in Arlington. Heddle. Hi, Heddle.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I wanted to address that, you know, a lot of concerned parents, we were talking about this yesterday, and there were also people that are against it. And the biggest argument is freedom. We have freedom to do whatever we want to do, and our kids have freedom. But the reality is our kids don't have freedom in school to do whatever they want to do. They have to follow all kinds of dress codes and school policies. And why not implement one that is going to save their lives and prevent them from being hospitalized? I think the other thing that people don't realize is that, you know, we have a lot of leaders pushing for vaccinations right now, but that's not going to help us in 2 weeks. And so we do the things, the right things like vaccinations, so we don't have to have everybody wearing a mask all the time. But when that doesn't work, we have to go back to masks. And when that doesn't work, we have to shut down things. And no one wants to shut down. And unfortunately, for parents like me that have young children, we're the first people that have to shut down ourselves. We have to stay at home when these outbreaks happen.
How old are your kids, Heddle? And are they both school age?
Well, my son is, my elder son is 3 years old, and he's going to be starting school for the first time at Axon this fall. We kept him home last year because he was 2 years old and couldn't wear a mask, and so we didn't want to put him in school until we knew that the safety protocols were working. And now we know what they need to do and what's going to work. And I think the other thing is that we have to really think about the fact that, you know, we also don't have a majority of our school staff that's vaccinated as well. So when the CDC said vaccinated people don't have to wear masks, parents like me, it took away a lot of our freedoms because we were able to go to indoor places, put a mask on our three-year-old and do things knowing everybody else would be masked. But now we can't do that. We also had lower COVID numbers, so we felt safer. We, like many people, had reunions over the summer.
Yeah, sure.
We're happy.
We all thought it was getting better. I know.
Yes.
I know.
We all thought we had our freedom because we did the right thing and got vaccinated. We thought it was just a matter of time before our kids got vaccinated, and now we know those have been delayed.
I know it, and I hate to cut you off. It's just we're coming up to a break. That's Heddle calling. Thank you, Heddle. Matt, the timing of this is terrible. Vaccines won't be available for children for several more weeks or months. So what's your next move, you and the activists you're working with?
Well, we're just asking parents to keep up the pressure. Just keep letting Dr. Green and the school board know that you want masks to be required. So you can write in, you can email, you can call. Let's just keep the pressure up to let them know this is the right thing. We support them in doing it. And that's all we can do on our side.
Matt Hartley, thanks for joining us. We'll continue to follow the story.
Thank you.
Okay, much more still ahead. Later in the hour, a closer look at the winning design for the former Jacksonville landing site and what's going to be going in that spot. But up next.
I had a patient argue with me while I'm pushing him to the ICU to be intubated that the vaccine wouldn't have made a difference, that he doesn't really believe he has COVID, that this is just all political nonsense to make Trump look bad.
Incredible tales from the COVID ward as a local ER nurse tells us about the situation at her overwhelmed hospital. We'll be right back. Well, as the Delta variant rampages through the area, healthcare professionals say they're near the breaking point. They've been on the front lines of this pandemic for a year and a half now. Things were starting to improve, but of course, ICUs are filling up once again. And almost every time, it's unvaccinated patients who are getting seriously ill. Last week, I spoke with a nurse working the COVID ward in a local hospital. We aren't revealing her name or where she works, and we've slightly modified her voice at her request. This is her story. Hey, so good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you're a veteran nurse, registered nurse, and you've
Correct.
Been working in the ER of an area hospital as this latest COVID surge rampages through the community. Could you begin by just telling our listeners what it's like right now in the ER and in the ICU at your hospital with these patients?
Well, in my hospital for the last 4 weeks, I've been assigned to the ER. I float to whatever department is most critically staffed. And lately, that has been the emergency room. So on any average day for at least the last 3 weeks, we have been holding 40 or more patients. Holding patients basically means these patients are admitted to the hospital. They need to be admitted, but we have no bed for them. So they are stuck waiting in the ER until someone upstairs is either discharged home or someone upstairs dies. And because of that, we've had patients sitting in the ER for 3, 4, and 5 days. The sickest ER patients, the ones that need to be critically monitored by nursing staff while they're waiting for a bed, we try to move them into the actual emergency room part, either in a room on a stretcher or lately for the last 2 weeks, we have been out of rooms. And so the way we deal with that is we have additional stretchers in storage and those come in and we make hallway beds. And you can walk through the ER and there's pieces of paper taped to the sides that say, you know, hall bed 2, hall bed 3. And normally those hallway beds are outside of the actual rooms that have those numbers. And we ran out of hallway beds last week. So now we also have nursing station beds. So these are people either on stretchers or sitting in recliner chairs or just in a chair that are stationed around the nurse's station. We have signs on the walls that say nurse's station 1, 2, 3, 4. Yesterday we got up to 6 nurse's station beds. And then we've also created something called vertical rooms, which are rooms that there are no bed in it, but we have several chairs in those rooms and people are sitting in chairs. For the people that we consider like walkie-talkie, not critical, those patients are actually waiting in the waiting rooms. They have hospital bands on. They're still getting their blood work done. They're still going to imaging. Doctors are coming to the waiting room to see them. So they're still being treated, but they're not being closely monitored because we don't have enough space to put them.
And to be clear, let's just explain. The reason for all this crowding is just because you've been overwhelmed with COVID patients, right?
Yes. So, like, the average person in the hospital is generally there for, like, 3 to 5 days. And a normal pneumonia, like a community-acquired pneumonia, something like that, if they're in the ICU at all, they're maybe only in the ICU for a day or two. And then they go to the progressive care unit for a day or two, and then maybe to the tele floor, and then they go home. COVID patients are in the hospital for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, and they're in the ICU on ventilators for weeks at a time. And so not only do we have more patients because of these COVID patients, but they're taking up the bed for longer, which is what is leading to our critical staffing. You know, I think almost a quarter of the patients at my hospital are all COVID.
Wow, that is a huge chunk.
It is. You know, yesterday of the 40, I think we started with 45 holding patients. I had 7 of those patients that were holding. I know that 5 of my 7 were COVID. The same thing with the other nurses that were holding patients as well. There's just nowhere to put them all because they take up beds. And unfortunately, with the COVID patients, we can't put them in a semi-private room. You know, they have to be in a private room. They can't be in a room with somebody who doesn't have COVID. So they really do take up a lot of space. And from I ask every single patient I have, did you get vaccinated and do you wear a mask? I have only had one patient for me personally that was vaccinated and was in the hospital with COVID. I know hospital-wide, I think there's been 6 or 7 that have been vaccinated, but I would say 98 to 99% of our patients are unvaccinated.
And do they also tell you that they haven't been masking?
Yes. A lot of them have not been masking. They say they have not worn a mask since the very beginning. They thought things were getting better. They didn't see a reason to start masking now, you know, despite top scientists and medical professionals trying to tell the world that this Delta variant is more transmissible. It is affecting our young people more, which I'm not sure that it's really getting the young people sicker because of the variant, or are we seeing more young sick people because our older population got vaccinated?
Yeah, it may be a little bit of both, but
we talk about it and discuss it daily, trying to figure out, you know, is this a vaccination issue? And all of our doctors and nurses and people working in the ER and on the floors, we're all kind of seeing the same thing. It's unvaccinated patients who are taking risk. They're still going on vacations. They're going places. I'm vaccinated. I had COVID. I had COVID in September. I got vaccinated in December and January, and I still wear a mask everywhere I go.
Sure. Let me ask you then, I know you can't divulge too much about your patients, but if you could, tell me about some of these patients and what they say to you, the really sick patients who are coming in and they didn't get vaccinated for whatever reason, and then they realize that if they had been vaccinated, perhaps they wouldn't be coming into the ICU, or most likely they wouldn't be. What are they saying to you, and what's that like for them and for you?
You know, it's really a mixed bag. I'd say it's about 50-50. About 50% of my patients say, oh my gosh, if I would have known it was this bad, I would have got vaccinated. To those patients, I beg them, please post on your Facebook, call your friends, call your family, describe how terrible you feel. Describe what the conditions are like in the hospital. You know, how long does it take us to get to you on a call light because we don't have enough staff? And those patients are all very, yes, I'm absolutely doing that. This is so bad. You know, I'm going to get vaccinated after the recommended waiting time from having COVID. I won't make this mistake again. And then we have patients on the other hand who say, it doesn't matter how they feel. I had a patient argue with me while I'm pushing him to the ICU to be intubated. That the vaccine wouldn't have made a difference, that he doesn't really believe he has COVID, that this is just all political nonsense to make Trump look bad. So we get a lot of that. We get a lot of, you're telling me I have COVID because the government is giving you a bonus to tell me I have COVID.
Mm. What's that like for you as a healthcare professional?
It's exhausting and infuriating and frustrating. And I cry and I get mad and I rage because my life is extremely different for the last year and a half as far as what I'm able to do. I went through a period of time where I isolated myself from all of my family because I was working the COVID unit. I went through a period of time where we didn't go anywhere. The work environment is so stressful and we are all trying so hard. You know, normally as a PCU nurse, I would have, you know, 3 to 4 patients. When I worked the ICU, I would have 1 to 2 patients. Now in the ER, you're supposed to have 4 patients. But on a regular, we have 7, 8, 9 patients. In the PCU, instead of 3 or 4, we're having 5, 6, and 7 patients. We don't have the staff. Many nurses have left the bedside. They're frustrated. They're tired. They're burnt out. The amount of overtime we're working is incredible. You feel a sense of guilt if you don't say yes and go in for the overtime because you know that your coworkers, the people you care about, these are our family. We spend more time at work than we do at home. And you know that if you're not there, your family is drowning. They're not eating, they're not peeing, they're crying, they're stressed out, are they going to miss something? And it's just incredibly frustrating to have somebody be so ignorant as to look at us and say, the mask couldn't have helped. Well, the mask definitely helps. I'm in a COVID room every single day.
Yeah, I mean, the masks help. Obviously, the vaccines help. So, you know, they're saving people's lives. What's your message to folks listening to this right now who are still not ready to be vaccinated?
The biggest thing that I can express to people is that this is about more than just COVID. My hospital last week had to shut down for 4 hours for rescue. When that happens, that means that those patients that are critically ill, critically injured, having a stroke, having a heart attack, have been in a car accident, when a hospital is too overwhelmed to take one more rescue, those patients have to go to a hospital that is further away. So I want them to think about their family and who in their family are they okay with getting delayed care because they didn't want to get vaccinated or they didn't want to wear a mask. You know, when your father has had a heart attack and you want nothing more than for him to be at the closest hospital so he can be on the cath lab table within minutes and have his arteries reopened and his heart saved, that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen right now. Every hospital is at max capacity. There's a meeting among the hospital leaders in the morning. Every hospital is at max capacity. So not only are you putting yourself at risk of getting COVID and dying, your family at risk of losing you, spreading it to someone you love, you're at risk of losing somebody in your family for a tragedy or an illness that they could not have prevented no matter what.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. And thank you for all the work you're doing to help patients, even the very frustrating ones, that you are fulfilling your mission as a nurse. Thanks for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, there's a winner in the contest to design a new concept for the former Jacksonville landing site. Christopher Counts is the design principal at Perkins and Will, the winning firm. He's on the line to tell us more about his company's winning design and what it will mean for Jacksonville. Hi, Christopher.
Hello.
Hey,
thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you. And congratulations. You won the Jacksonville Riverfront Plaza Design Competition. You're a Chicago-based firm. Pretty exciting.
Yes. Yes, it is exciting. We're thrilled.
Okay, and for people who haven't seen the renderings yet that you submitted, let's talk about this, because your presentation involves completely redoing the section of the North Bank where the Jacksonville Landing used to stand, but
that's
the
right.
Focal point is this huge metallic sculpture, which partially resembles the words J-A-X or Jax. Although it can be interpreted in different ways, depending on how you look at it. It's an art installation not unlike the famous Bean or the Cloud Gate in Chicago in Millennium Park. Now, since you guys won this thing, there has been a ton of discussion on social media about this. People who are passionately excited about the Jax sculpture and people who hate it and think it's a waste of money. What are your thoughts?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll start with the sculpture. It's something that developed with a, you know, within our kind of collaborative team. One of the missions that the DIA challenged us with, all of the design teams, was to come up with a scheme, a proposal, in which the art in the landscape, or the art in the park, if you will, were seamlessly integrated, and they kind of fed off each other. So we went through numerous iterations to try to kind of find that just that right fit that would have these elements. I think the Bean is a great example. Not only is it it has some kind of material and kind of programmatic connections to what Jack's sculpture is about, but it also is a great kind of precedent story or success story in terms of art really generating traffic, art becoming a focal point and a kind of sense of identity for the entire city, much less the park, and a real engine for economic growth. So, I think that is, those are the kind of ideas that we've been working with and aspirations we have for the park and for the sculpture.
Can you explain a little bit further how you envision this design being a driver of economic growth and tourism for Jacksonville?
Right, right, right. So it's, the sculpture is just one piece of it, right? It's obviously, when you zoom out, you know, it is very large and it's prominent and it's iconic, and that's kind of part of the challenge that we were asked to address. But there's also lots of other really kind of, we think, very exciting moments. I mean, one of the, you know, our kind of internal design goals was to kind of capture some of the magic and the energy of the landing at its prime, and kind of infuse that into a kind of 21st century waterfront park that has all the experiences, has all of the kind of classic park program and beauty. So kind of meld those two together. So it's an element that is kind of intentionally difficult to see from the kind of a lot of the news media has been using the kind of aerial shot from across the river. And what it kind of describes, the Jack sculpture is very prominent. It's lifted up on a 10-foot set of civic stairs that then connects up to the Main Street Bridge. And then it's also kind of framed around this very large, simple, classic civic lawn that is meant to be, you know, open, flexible, movies in the park, concerts, all the reasons why many of the great civic parks and public parks, public spaces throughout the world, usually include a large lawn, right? Mm-hmm. But around the perimeter and underneath the trees, we're proposing approximately, I believe it's over 4 acres of shade. And I myself am a Florida-based designer, and I know if there's no shade, you know,
that's no good.
Stay very long. Right, right. So, and around these, so if you think about the kind of around the perimeter, if you will, so we have this, you know, destination playground also shaded, but river terraces, waterfront areas, outdoor dining, and then all of that is kind of tucked into the landscape, if you will, and we think in a real kind of interesting, innovative way. But, you know, we'll have restaurants, cafes, coffee shops, rooftop bars, public bathrooms, gift shop. And all of this is kind of meant to activate the space and give and provide a range of activities and experiences that will keep people coming back. You know, one of the, one of our messages is one park for Jacks. And what that really means to us fundamentally is that there's something to do for everyone. And that everyone feels at home, feels welcome and excited to
be there. Yes.
Exactly.
And we look forward to seeing it come together. And congratulations, Chris. Christopher Counts, design principal at Chicago's Perkins and Will, the winning team behind the Jacksonville Riverfront Plaza Design Competition. You can see the images at our website at wjct.org. Thanks so much, Christopher.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And in a moment, how Edible is giving you sunshine on a plate this month. Stay with us.
I'm Robin Young. With only 1% of Africans vaccinated, the pandemic is raging there, taking lives of the infected, but also those who can't get care as hospitals focus on COVID.
The ripple effect is huge. So where does the woman that's 8.5 months pregnant go? And where does the malnourished child go to be weighed?
We touch down in Zambia next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9. Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings wrote about Florida in the 1930s and 40s. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Anne McCutcheon, author of The Life She Wished to Live, a biography of Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings. We'll discuss Florida's territorial period and endangered historic places. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Jad Abumrad, producer of Radiolab, the public radio show and podcast. The new Radiolab miniseries is called The Vanishing of Harry Pace. You may be thinking, Harry who? Well, for one thing, he founded the first black-owned record company in 1921. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Last year, this nation's birth rate fell to a new record low. Felicia in Utah thinks she knows why.
It's not just the climate catastrophe. I just cannot get the same kind of money together that my parents could, you know.
That COVID baby boom turned out to be a bust. So what's getting in the way of so many being in the family way? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the latest issue of Edible Northeast Florida just hit the stands. It's called The Sunshine Plate, and it's a bit of a travelogue covering the state's most iconic foods, including some from our corner of Florida, and information on festivals, you-pick farms, and roadside attractions. Editor-in-Chief Lauren Titus is on the line with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
I love this. The new issue is called The Sunshine Plate, but it's about much more than Florida's citrus. Tell us what you rounded up this month.
Yeah, although, you know, citrus arrived in Florida, in North America, in the 1500s with the Spanish settlers. But as you say, Florida's foods have become quite diverse since then. For instance, in Northeast Florida, one of the more popular sandwiches is called the Camel Rider. And that's a result of Jacksonville's Arab population, which has the 10th largest Arab population and the 5th largest Syrian population of any city in America. So that dish has become kind of an iconic lunchtime sandwich that mm-hmm. you can find throughout Northeast Florida.
And always served with the cherry limeade, right? That's the local tradition.
Right, and a side of tabbouleh. Uh-huh.
And a side of tabbouleh. Yeah. Is it the 10th largest? I thought we had a bigger Arab American population than that.
Our research showed that it was the 10th largest Arab population in any city in America.
And they have such an impact in this community. The culinary space is just one way, but that's so cool that you included that in the issue. But you go all over the state with this. Tell us about some of the other standouts.
Yeah, well, one popular dish over on the southwest area of Florida is a heart of palm salad that comes from the cabbage palm, also known as the swamp cabbage. And there's actually a festival that celebrates hearts of palm being used in different dishes. So that's kind of a fun one. Of course, people know about key lime pie and key limes from the Keys. Mayport shrimp is another fun one that we cover. You know, people don't realize that the term Mayport shrimp, it was originated as a marketing term to get more consumers to eat shrimp. Although that the shrimp is caught off the northeast coast of Florida, it's not necessarily caught in Mayport. It just primarily is processed in Mayport. Another fun one that people might not realize has such a significant impact to the survival of St. Augustine is the mullet, a fish that is both saltwater and freshwater. It's got an interesting legacy in St. Augustine. Often when the mullet were running, you could hear a cry of mullet on the beach, and the legend goes that the cathedral was emptied with all of the families running out with their mullet nets to catch mullet to either eat fresh or to smoke. And since then, it's become a very popular smoked fish dip.
Sure. And speaking of St. Augustine, Dadle Peppers can date their origin to St. Aug, right?
Yeah, so that's got an interesting legacy as well. There's some confusion perhaps about where the dattle pepper comes from, whether it was from Menorca or Cuban, but most researchers are agreeing lately that Cuba is the source of it. It's actually a very, very hot pepper, ranging between 100,000 to 300,000 on the Scoville heat rating, similar to a habanero pepper. And there is almost every Menorcan family has their own version of a dattle pepper sauce. And we have a dattle pepper festival coming up in October where people can sample every variety of dish using dattle pepper, including a chocolate-covered dattle pepper.
Let's talk about festivals, because in this latest issue of Edible, we learn about the Blue Crab Festival in Palatka, the strawberry festivals in Stark and Palm Coast, and the shrimp festival in Fernandina Beach. Lots of fun stuff coming up on the calendar, right?
Yeah, you can practically eat your way through the year at all of these different festivals. You know, you mentioned the ones in Northeast Florida. The shrimp festival, of course, is a very popular one in Fernandina, and it ties into not only the culinary history, but the history of Fernandina itself with the eight flags that have flown over Fernandina. Of course, blueberries are a popular U-pick product in our area. We've got a ton of listings for U-pick blueberry farms. And Mount Dora, which is not too far from here, has an annual blueberry festival in April. There's a sweet corn festival in West Palm Beach. There's a watermelon festival over in Chipley where they have a seed spitting contest.
There's a what spitting contest?
A seed spitting watermelon.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. And if you want to venture into some of the unusual products that Florida has become known for, head over to Wausau in the Panhandle and attend the Possum Festival in August.
Oh, my gosh. You can learn all about it if you pick up the latest issue of Edible Northeast Florida. It's free on newsstands across the community. The Sunshine Plate is this month's issue. Editor-in-Chief Lauren Titus, always bringing us the delicious details. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Melissa.
And thanks for listening. Thanks also to producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for listening. This is WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Catch our podcast up later today on all platforms. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.